that is parallel to the evil that existed just prior to the flood. A number of things are quite important for that. We know that prior to the flood, there was a demonic invasion, which certainly will be paralleled by the confining of Satan and his demons to the earth at the middle of Daniel's 70th week. But even before that, one of the passages we have in Revelation 18 with respect to Babylon is that the nation has become a haunt of every unclean, a prison of every unclean and every hated spirit, which denotes that even prior to the destruction of the U.S., that it has become invaded in large measure by demonic activity. Well, 28, we know that the situation at that time was characterized by demonic invasion, which is certainly going to be the case following the middle of Daniel's 70th week. But even before that, you have the situation as per Babylon, and the fact that man had basically capitulated to his sin nature and engaged it continually. Genesis 6:5 deals with the nature of mankind at that time. And given the study of Genesis and knowing what we do about the angelic infiltration, that they had crossed genetic boundaries, which were forbidden by God, and yet they did it anyway, and they gave birth to the sterile but very evil angel men. These angel men, of course, became quite famous during their time in history, as they would have had in some ways supernatural power, supernatural strength, supernatural wisdom, and all of that. And they became the mythological characters of folklore. And so in mythology, one of the things that we've always suggested is that mythology, while it seems bizarre sometimes, you know, winged horses and people like Hercules and these types of things, that there is a kernel of truth to this, that the kernel of truth comes out of this period of history prior to the flood, in which these legendary heroes were on the planet. So, but man basically had capitulated to the sin nature. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. That's where we're headed at the second advent, that that type of evil will once again permeate the earth, and that mankind is devoted to various forms of evil. I mean, whatever the divine viewpoint is on a matter, you can pretty much bet that humanity has rejected it and has opted for something else. And all, you know, in the nature of political correctness, in the nature of personal freedom, in the name of all these other things they suppose. But the fact is, they're just pursuing evil. They just do it under a different guise. 29, the Jews will further insult and infuriate God by their willing acceptance of Antichrist, bringing his wrath on them, as per Daniel 9. 27, we saw there in the study of Daniel that, and this obviously, Daniel 9 is critical to an understanding of prophetic history. But Daniel 9:27, and he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. And that refers to his agreement with Israel to act as their savior, as their Messiah, and protector for recognition of, in exchange for being recognized as their Messiah. And Jesus prophesied with respect to that in John when he said that if I come in my name, you don't accept me, but if another comes in his own name, him you will accept, which was a reference to their willing acceptance of Antichrist and their rejection of him. 30, the world at large is indicted for rejecting God's truth and embracing the lie, which is manifested in their acceptance of Antichrist and the mark, as we have seen repeatedly in 2 Thessalonians 2, 10 through 12, that this judgment comes upon them because of their embrace of evil and their willing acceptance, their rejection of the truth, and their willing acceptance of the deluding influence. And they believe the lie, and of course this sets them up for judgment in which God can step in without, no one is going to really, other than the evil people themselves, no one in their right mind would question God's right to judge all this. That this evil is continuing to deteriorate, it is continuing to intensify, it is continuing to mature, and the fact is it's only getting worse day by day out there. And so really in the last days, even in the last days of the church age, you have to have a lot of iron in your soul, because there's a lot of stupidity that's going on out there, a lot of evil, a lot of insanity, and a lot of people that are just deluded with respect to what the truth is. They've got their own weird views of things, and that's what they believe the truth is. Well, the truth isn't what they believe it is. The truth is an objective reality. And so they've rejected all that, and so then now you have a situation where God can step in and judge them without any violation of his righteousness at all. It shouldn't even be called into question. So 31, the world is not merely an evil place comprised of basically good people. It is comprised of people that are evil, love that evil, exploit that evil, continue in that evil, and exult in that evil. As per the prophecies, our nation is heavily engaged in this. Isaiah 13:11. And and I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. And I will put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. And the leadership in our nation, unfortunately, as the ringleader in this cosmic rebellion in the last days, this international conspiracy against God, which is run, we know, by and large, by a very few people who are at the top. Some of these people in our government, you have to recognize there are various types of people out there. In any conspiracy, you have a very, very small, in order for it to be effective, you can't let very many people know about it. And so you have a very, very small group of actual conspirators. And they hatch their plans, they get into their machinations, their tedious plots, and how they're going to carry it out, and what they've got to do, and how they're going to do it. And then you have the larger group of their henchmen, people who know whatever they need to know. And so they're not in on all the details of the conspiracy or where it's headed or any of that. Like, they may just need to know, you need to go out and do this today. And so they go out and do it. They willingly are accomplices to this. They never really search out, well, you know, is this evil? Or should I be doing this? Or what's this all about? They just willingly take orders. And in many cases, as you probably know, a lot of this is driven by money, one might expect. And in this case, because it's the international bankers and the international money men from both Europe and America, it's largely driven by money. That this is the opiate that controls the masses in many cases. And then, of course, you have the bigger, broader group of the people out here who don't know. They just are unaware of it, but it's all going on. Whether they're aware of it or not, it's really irrelevant. But you have out here what we like to call the dupes. They're being conspired against. It's going on right in front of their eyes, but they don't really see it. And they're not interested in seeing it. And so even in the henchmen group, though, like people in the U.S. government, you probably have congressmen who know very much about what's going on, are very actively involved in it. And then you probably have other people who know very little about it, but just continue to parrot the party line. And so they may not be. So don't get the idea that, like, every congressman is evil or everybody knows everything about all of this. They don't. In some measure, they're given only the light they need to do, we might say, in order to do their job. So again, the arrogance of the proud and the haughtiness of the ruthless, that pretty well characterizes our country. John 3:19, where Jesus indicts the world at large for its refusal to accept the truth, rejection of the light. And this is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. And this is why they have an agenda. They're busy pursuing their agenda of evil, and they don't really want to be exposed to this. So if you want to make someone really uncomfortable real quick, just start talking about doctrine to them. And you'll find out that very often they'll just run in the opposite direction. They will literally vacate the premises to get away from it. Because they assume, wrongly so, that if I don't know, then I'm not culpable, which is dumb. I mean, that's not true in any area of human life or human endeavor. I mean, when the policeman stops you, the fact that you didn't know you were sinning or speeding or whatever it was you were doing doesn't get you off the hook, near as I can tell. Ignorance will not get you off the hook. So as much as they might think that, that's not the case. Also, John 7:7. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that its deeds are evil. And then 1 John 5:19 deals with the fact that the whole world lies, reclines, is comfortable in the lap of the evil one. That's the nature of the cosmos. It's not as though these people are just out there. They're comfortable with their evil. They are engaged in it. They embrace it. It doesn't bother them. Satan doesn't bother them. His forms of evil don't bother them to speak of. The whole world lies in the power, as it says, of the evil one. The whole idea really would better be the lap. That they actually, the word kaima means to recline, to lie down. And so they're comfortable with all this. 32, while the adjusted believer does evil from time to time and engages the STA, the sin against God, he does not have the same attitude towards his actions that the cosmos has in regard to their evil. Romans 7:19, as Paul here delineates issues with respect to the sin nature and all of that. And surely as a believer, hopefully you're smart enough to know that when you're sinning and you're under your STA, you should be able to identify that, and you should rebound it. And you say, well, you know, like for instance, I had a real test this week, and I was really furious, and I'd rebound, and I'd be furious 5 seconds later, and I'd rebound again, and I'd furious again, and rebound again, and you got to just keep fighting it. You cannot give in to it. And that's the danger, of course, is that you just give in to it. You just have to deal with it. You say, well, I'd have to rebound 1,000 times a day. Then so be it. You keep fighting. You keep rebounding 1,000 times a day if you have to. And you keep fighting, and eventually what you'll find is that you'll get on top of it. If you have to continue the fight, though, you cannot capitulate to it. And that's the real challenge, because there's those times, like when you're under your STA, and you don't even care. I mean, there's those times when you're under your STA and you hate it. And there's those times when you're under your STA and you don't even care. It's fine with you. You're miserably unhappy. And you enjoy that. You wouldn't be happy if you weren't unhappy. In a sense, it just trips your trigger for whatever reason. We're weird. I mean, let's face it, people under their STAs are weird. And we get very weird, and it doesn't take very long. That's a fact. And so when dealing with the STA, we recognize we have evil that's present in this body, that no good dwells within me, that is, within my flesh, and that we engage under that, and willingly so sometimes, and you just have to fight it. And have to acknowledge that it's wrong. You can't begin to rationalize it with, like, my deal this week was anger. But you can't very well rationalize it and say, well, hey, everybody's angry. You know. Yeah, but that doesn't get you off the hook with God. Just because everybody may be angry, but that doesn't get you off the hook. And so you have to fight this stuff. And you have to recognize it for what it is. And if you have to rebound, you know, every 5 seconds, you do it. And you deal with it, and you keep fighting, and you get on. Eventually, you'll get on top of it if you continue the fight. The STA can be beaten with doctrine. That's got to kill Satan to know that. That is what I assume this he thought when God judged Adam, and he tripped Adam up, and Adam sinned, and that sin was imputed into his body, and now he's got a genetic link into the human race. Satan had to figure this is going to be easy. But he never anticipated the power of God's word. He never anticipated the reality that doctrine can overcome the STA. Not in a sense to make you sinlessly perfect in this life, but that the doctrine can overcome. You know, and I'd be sitting there, you know, 1 minute I'd be mad, and I'd say, all right, Lord, I know, you know, I'd be quoting verses to myself, the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God, but I don't care. And then, you know, I'd think of another verse, and, you know, and I'd rage back and forth in myself. And I know none of you have been through this, but just to describe it for you a little bit of what it's like, well, it's miserable. It's absolutely miserable. Do you like the way you feel when you're out of fellowship? And granted, we're not to run our lives on our feelings. I'm not suggesting that. But do you really like the way you feel then? And that's part of the unpleasantness of the whole thing. Well, the cosmos, they're not like that. They don't care. To them, evil is fine. They never deal with it. They never judge it. They just go along and do their thing and assume that God's for them, which is really dumb, but that's the way they do it. So again, we don't have the same attitude about it. Romans 7:19, for the good that I wish, I do not do, but I practice the very evil that I do not wish. And then this gets into the issue of if I, and this is where you got, and I would really like to do this book sometime. I don't want to take it on next. I got to do something small next, you know. I'm looking for a book with like one chapter, you know. Maybe I'll do Jonah or something. You know, something a little less daunting, let's say. But it's been, you know, it's been good. It's been, you know, God's gotten me through it, but it's been a challenge. So, but you got to, what I'd like to get in to do this is the who is the I in each of these things that he's talking about. For verse 15, for instance, for what I am doing, I don't understand. Well, how can you not understand what you're doing? And for I am not practicing what I would like to do. The I that I'm not practicing, that's the I under the STA, is not practicing what I, me in fellowship, would like to do. And he uses I through here. One of the things you see if you look down through verses 15 and really starting in verse 14, look how many times you see the word I in here. And is it always referring to the same thing? Well, it's referring to Paul, no doubt. But is it the inner man of Paul? Is it Paul in fellowship? Is it Paul out of fellowship? Is it Paul just in his own thinking? What am I like? You know, just sort of in a neutral sense. And those are the kinds of questions that really this passage is fascinating. It's a great study in human psychology with related to the sin nature and how we deal with it and how we orient to it. So, but at any rate, we get the whole point of all of this here is that number one, we don't see it the same way they do. And the point is that Satan didn't see that this genetic link into the STA was not going to be without its problems, that it can be overcome. So, again, while we engage the STA, we recognize it's wrong, hopefully. You should recognize you're wrong when you're out of fellowship and say, okay, now I've got to get back in fellowship. And that's the challenge because it's a day-to-day, moment-to-moment, hour-by-hour fight, and it doesn't ever give up. You might have periods where you go through it and it's relatively calm. I enjoy those a lot. But then you have those periods where it's just raging. And this is a part of taking every thought captive. You've got to just deal with it. And the battle is all right in here, unfortunately. And, you know, while people can do things, the fact is people aren't our problem. They aren't our enemy. It's the evil that dwells within each of us that trips us up. You say, well, I wouldn't have any problem if there weren't any idiots in the world. Well, I wouldn't either, I don't think. But then again, I might not be here because from time to time, I myself am an idiot. So, and you got these tests, people, patience, you know, macrothumia, patience with regard to people, long-suffering, hupomone, patience regard to circumstances. You just have, and that's a challenge. Like we get up in the morning, we got our agenda, we got it all laid out, we know what we're going to do, and then suddenly a kink's thrown into it. And then what do? Well, you scream and rage at God like an idiot. That's the way to handle it. Well, no, obviously that's not the way to handle it. We have to at that point orient it. And one of the most frustrating things is when you got your plans all laid out. And you got them all, their ducks in a row. You know, I mean, you're ready. You're just, I'm out of the chute. I'm ready to go. And then all of a sudden, suddenly there's a brick wall in front of you. Well, you can keep bashing your head against it, but it won't do you any good. You just have to say, okay, now maybe God's got a different plan. How could God have a different plan without consulting me? What was he thinking? Well, that's where we have to orient to him. That's a part of humbling yourself under his hand. So, here, again, we don't look at it the same way they do. But if you don't have the mental attitude straight, this all starts there. And if your thinking isn't straight, your actions are never going to be straight. You don't have a snowball's chance. You've got to think the right thing before you can do the right thing. Well, 33, the phrase, the vine of the earth, is to be understood as referring to one thing. The genitive earth is epexegetical and identifies the vine in view. 34, in this context, the vine that is the earth refers to the place where the grapes grow and signifies the fact that those that are negative find their place in this world alone. And again, they're happy here. 35, the explanation for the command is contained in the haughty clause that follows. which is the fact that the grapes are ripe. As is, you know, swing your sickle. Why? Because the grapes are ripe. And in, again, in that context, the grapes are very ripe. I mean, they are to the point of maturity and beyond in evil. So 36, the verb akmazo, to ripen, is used only here and denotes the time when things that are at their, are in their prime, when things are in full bloom and at their peak. 37, here it refers to the time at the end of the growing season, at which the grapes are fully mature and it is time for the harvest to commence. 38, the angel responds obediently and in a violent motion casts the edge of the sharp sickle right into the midst of humanity. That's the emphasis of ice with the accusative. 39, he harvests the vine of the earth, which is a collective singular, that views the enemies as coming from a common vine, while the distinct grapes represent the individuals. 40, while it is not explicit in the Greek text, the clusters of grapes are what he casts into the winepress. You put the sickle in, and the clusters that he cuts off, we might say, are what gets thrown into the winepress of the wrath of God. 31, one should understand that the genitive wrath is also exegetical and defines for us what the winepress is. It is the wrath of God and how he expresses that. 42, the genitive of God should be understood in a subjective sense. This supplies the subject and indicates that the wrath is produced by God. God is the one that produces the wrath in response to the evil of men. And obviously this is a factor that comes out of his righteousness. It's not as though God walks around angry. But this deals with the orientation of righteousness to evil and how he deals with evil. 43, there is a grammatical anomaly. Which is quite common in this book. And the final descriptive adjective, ton megon, the great, does not grammatically agree with the noun winepress. And it doesn't agree, we'll go on with this here. 44, there have been many attempts to explain this, suggesting that it is a simple error, as Sweet suggests, or it is attracted to the masculine noun wrath, to emphasize the wrath of God as symbolized by the winepress, as per Kittel and Moons. 45, some scribes attempted to correct what they perceived to be an obvious mistake, and some manuscripts have the masculine form of the adjective great, as opposed to the neuter form, if I believe is what it is. It's accusative masculine singular is what they have there, and that's what they've done. Well, 46, in any case, it must be taken with the wine press. That's the only way, really, you can take this, although some have tried to put it with God's wrath. But the wine press itself is great or large or all of that, which echoes the passage in Isaiah about the eschatological wine press and the one who treads it, which we read during the first session, Isaiah 63, 2 and 6. 47, our verse in Revelation is designed to demonstrate that angels will play a significant role in the final destruction of the wicked at the second advent. 48, they will be responsible for assembling those that will be cast into the winepress, where they will suffer physical death. And 49, it should be noted here that this chapter very much concerns itself with the whole wrath process, beginning with God's wrath poured out in the bowl judgments, which we're going to see in verse 6 or chapter 16, continuing with God's wrath that ends the phase 2 of the negative unbelievers, and that's what we have here, and concluding with God's eternal wrath on those that worship the beast, as we saw in the previous verses, that cannot be interpreted strictly in a temporal sense. They have to be interpreted in an eternal sense because we're talking about forever and ever in here. So that has to be taken into the eternal future. And really, chapter 15, in some ways, just sets up the introduction for what we're going to get in chapter 16 and sort of puts the world on notice that commencing with the bowl judgments, which are the final judgments, that commencing with those that at that time, just before they commence, the temple of God in heaven is closed. And if you look ahead into chapter 15 there, the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God, verse 8, and from his power. And no one was able to enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished. And so you have sort of this introduction here to sort of put people on notice that God is not going to be able to be approached during this time. That this is not a time for mercy or grace. This is a time for extreme final outpouring of judgment that's going to culminate in the destruction of the wicked and the cleansing of planet Earth and the establishment of the millennial kingdom and all of that. And God does some very horrible things to these people at the end of Daniel's 70th week. It's not as though horrible things haven't been happening to them right along. I mean, you've got to figure that the world is going to be a very chaotic place following the Soviet attack on the U.S. That's got to send them spinning. Financial markets are going to crumble. People are going to be panic-stricken. The whole complexion of the world is going to change. We know that it's going to materially affect the day-night cycle, the speed of the earth, and all of that. And you got all those things and all the things that come out of that, as we've seen, that it's going to mess with the oxygen content of the air. Machines are going to have problems. You got a third of the sea force disabled. You got a third of the waters poisoned, the oceans at least at any rate. You got this nuclear fallout and all poisoning the natural water system. You have, after all of those things, the five-month invasion of the demonic locusts that torment these people. You have the, and all of this is just sort of coalescing towards the big move to Armageddon, to bringing all mankind together for the final battle. And, of course, Israel is the focal point of all this persecution and all that. Believers during this time are going to suffer mightily under the economic and political policies of the false prophet and the Antichrist. So it isn't as though things have been going, you know, along pretty good for them. Things have been deteriorating day by day by day by day by day. And then as you get down towards the end of this, then they get these horrific sores that break out on them, these ulcerative sores that you cannot fix. One of the things that you're going to have a problem with that I don't know that it had ever occurred to me, but the more I thought about it, the reality is that you're going to have a real problem with medicine and hospital facilities and all of this during this time as well. That you've lost a lot of ability to manufacture medicines. And if there are these, who knows what strain of viruses and bacteria may be spawned by all of this stuff. We haven't ever seen these kind of circumstances. And so how would you treat some of these things? Well, apparently there's no medical treatment for these runny sores that these people are going to get from the that have taken the mark of the beast. There's no mention of them trying to treat them. It doesn't appear that they can be healed. And then you got the factor that the earth is going to, then all the waters are turned to blood. The whole ecosystem is completely shut down. And then you have the sun is going to, at some point, have a mini nova. Not a full nova, obviously. Had a full nova, the earth, nobody on the earth would survive. But you're looking at temperatures that are scorching according to men's characteristics. Now, granted, it can get hot here in Florida with the humidity and the heat and all that. And, I mean, the heat index can be 105, 110. I don't think we're looking at those kind of temperatures. Now, that's what we normally have in Florida, in fact, in the summer anyway. And you go out into the desert or out, you know, to Vegas and all those places. And, I mean, it can be incredibly hot out there, 110, 115. 120 degrees. It's not a place you want to run outside and play volleyball in, really, you know, or you know, soccer or whatever else. But the reality is that's kind of what we would call normal heat. And we get into this with the sun, and they were scorching. It's scorching men with fire, not just what we would call hot temperatures, but temperatures that are on the verge of fiery hot. And so the whole thing is going to deteriorate. I mean, the heat is going to be incredible, and the sun is apparently, of course, the sun's going through, and we got some information on all this we'll give to you as we get into that, but the sun is going through these constant cycles and letting off these tremendous blasts and all of that, and the sun is becoming increasingly unstable, and there's going to be a major eruption on the sun that's going to dramatically affect the earth. And so the heat, and some have said that you get into the next deal where the kingdom of Antichrist is darkened, which refers predominantly to Europe, not to the entire world per se. But predominantly something's going to happen that's going to darken that portion of the world considerably. And some have said, well, when you're sitting in the dark, it's going to be very cold. No. It's going to be like being in an oven. You're going to be sitting in there and it's going to be incredibly hot. And you got these ulcerative runny sores all over you that won't heal and that apparently are pretty painful. And it's 150 degrees at 7 o'clock at night and you can't see. Well, that sounds kind of like a warm-up for hell, if you know what I mean. You know, it's kind of, are you guys getting ready yet? Because here's what you got coming. And that's nothing compared to the lake of fire, obviously. They're at least still alive, theoretically. You could say, well, they could have hope. Yeah, well, they don't because they're negative unbelievers. They choose not to have any hope. They're not going to turn to God no matter what you do to them. I mean, you can stick them in an oven and cook them like bread, and it won't get their attention. You know, roast them like turkeys for Thanksgiving. And there you go. Nope, that won't change me. And they're basting in their own juices. Oh, God, that's a disgusting picture. But that's what's going to be happening. So you got all that, and then, you know, again, this whole thing is just going to get so incredibly, you just wonder, how could they not get the picture? What is going on? How? Negative volition is very hard to understand. I mean, how can you not get this? And yet they never turn to God. They're still standing down there shaking their fists at him, blaspheming, calling him all kinds of names. And you can imagine what they might be saying, I suspect, given all these factors. So this is just going to continue to intensify for them, and then, of course, ultimately it culminates in their eternal judgment there in the lake of fire. All right, well, we're going to stop there today. We've got to, it's our time to observe the Lord's table, as we do every quarter. So if everyone will get all their things together and get that in place, we will observe this ritual.